Blog Talk Radio.
And now a brief message from our sponsor. Reality Books presents Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. The author is Marshall Washington Cabinus Abui, the senior great-grandson of Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, a message that will change America. Buy your copy today. $20 is all it costs, plus $5 postage and handling. To order your copy of the book written by the great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, send a text message. Include your full name and how many books you would like to purchase. Send to area code 706-399-5006. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. A message that will change America. Send your text message, including your full name and how many books you would like to purchase, to area code 706-399-5006. A brief word from our sponsor, Reality Books, publisher of Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. A short extract from the book, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. God will not change the condition of a people until they change what is in themselves. In other words, until they change their way of thinking. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution is designed to help African Americans and other ethnicities change their way of thinking. This is a book that will change America, and it is on sale for only $20 plus $5 postage and handling. You can order your book now by sending a text message to area code 706-399-5006. Please put your name and the number of books that you would like to order, and you will be contacted to arrange payment information so that the book can be mailed to you immediately. So please go ahead and don't hesitate. Order your copy today. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, published by Reality Books. The author of this book is the great-grandson, the senior great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, the founder of the famous Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, now known as Tuskegee University. The great-grandson of Booker T. Washington is inviting you to order his book. Send a text to area code 706-399-5006. The book is only $20 plus $5 postage and handling. Order your copy today. Thank you.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome again to the Booker T. Washington African American Family Room Forum on this 12th day of June 2021, as we move officially closer to summer, although for many people the summer season has already begun. People have begun to, for better or for worse, share their COVID precautions, taking off their masks, grouping together for social activities and whatnot, and getting ready for what they hope will be a great return to the normal activities of summertime. I personally encourage people to continue to still think safely. 600,000 people have died from COVID-19 since the reporting began back around January of 2020. So we still need to be careful, and certainly those who have not received a vaccine need to seriously consider getting vaccinated. I got mine. My wife and I got ours, even though I was reluctant. But I did go ahead, and I got it. So we don't want to begin with a sour note, a sad note, but people are still dying from COVID-19. I just talked to a friend of mine today, and several of his family members in the last year have died as a result of COVID-19. I've been fortunate so far that I haven't lost any of mine, but you never know. But anyway, to shift to a lighter note, we want to go ahead and welcome everyone. Those who are here that I see have entered the family room, that have called in to check in, to be part of our panel tonight. Welcome to you all. And those who are listening via the internet, which I know that there are a number of people that prefer just to listen, but if you do want to call in, call 657-383-0671. But before I go any further, I do want to check with my co-host, and I want to welcome Mr. Bianchi and ask him for a radio check. Mr. Bianchi, are you able to hear me?
Yeah, and Ham Radio Talk, you 88. Well, CD, so yes, you're good.
You know, I used to be a big-time CB-er. Not only did I have a base station with a base station-sized outdoor antenna where I could actually, from Alabama, I could reach all the way out to California on a good night without having any extra unlawful amplification added on to my signal. But I also had a mobile unit with two antennas on my car. I had one on each side of my roof of my car, and I'm sure that people looked at me and wondered. Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure people looked at me and wondered if I was.
I bet I can tell you what they were. I bet they were big mamas, weren't they?
Yep. But I was going to say, I'm sure people looked at me and thought I was some kind of special agent, you know, riding around checking on other CBs, but I wasn't. I was a regular guy out there myself, just trying to have a good time living.
And the channel you hung out on was Channel 6.
6 and 11.
6 and 11. Mm-hmm.
Now, for those of you who don't know about 6 and 11, 6 and 11 were the colored channels. That's what the white folks called us. But you could hear some great, great jokes and some great talk on those channels. And those guys, I never did could get the lingo down the way I wanted to. But those guys, you never knew what they talked about in real life. So they had a special language. They had a special way of talking when they got on the radio. And I used to just be so fascinated. But much as I tried to get that down, for some reason or another, I just never could write but I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, Ms. Bianca. But
well,
you
yeah,
don't
those
hear that.
Good old days.
CB time. But anyway, let's go ahead. The topic tonight, I decided would be caller's choice for several reasons. Number one is because of the fact that I really did not see anything that I could use as a prominent topic for tonight in the news about African-American people. And usually there's some political issue or some social issue that jumps out at me, but I didn't see anything. So I said I was going to go ahead and just have caller's choice, and people can just introduce what they want to. But before we do move on, and I'll start with our co-host, Ms. Bianca, but I want to welcome everyone by name. So Stephanie, welcome to you. And Brother Warren, welcome to you. And Sheikh John Kennebay, welcome to you. And listener, welcome to you. He just said this one thing, but we don't have to comment on it. You don't have to respond to it. But I just want to say this one thing. Now, for the last few months, there's been a big hoopla, a lot of noise, a lot of chatter, a lot of writing back and forth about this whole issue of teaching critical race theory. Now, I'll be honest with you, I'm an African-American historian, but that one got by me. Until a few months ago, I had not heard of critical race theory. One reason, because it's not something that's in textbooks that I use, and it's not something that's in the monograph that I have read, or in the scholarly journal articles that I have used for building my courses. But it is something that's being prominently discussed. But I have a concern about this whole argument, and that's the fact that some school districts and some states are banning not just the teaching of critical race theory, but things that can be associated with critical race theory, which is negative representations of American history that reflect badly on the behavior of white Americans. And I just want to say something, and I'm going to move on and let Mr. Bianca take it. Now, in 2015, I published a book entitled Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, and that's the book you hear advertised at the beginning of the show. Well, I updated that book, put a different title on it, but it's basically a lot of the same content. And now I'm actually selling the book under the title Booker T. Washington for a New America. Are we there yet? But a lot of content is still the same. And I just want to share this because I want to make a quick point after I read this brief excerpt from it. But there's a section in it, and it talks about the conditions that our people underwent during chattel slavery. And I have a picture there of a slave owner, an overseer, whipping a black slave that's dressed only in a loincloth, but has one of these neck, I don't know what you would call it. I would just call it a necklace that has long spokes on it, so he won't be able to run through the forest, because he gets caught up and get choked by the vines or by the small trees or whatever. And he's working while the slave owner or overseer is whipping him as he works. And that's a picture. Now, right there, this book will probably be banned from a lot of these schools just because of that one picture, even though that really happened. But to go further, in my book I said, slave, what does it mean? What are the short-term and the long-term effects of the condition of chattel slavery? And to give just a little excerpt, I said, according to Professor Thad W. Tate, this is a quote from a book by a scholar, a white scholar. He said, during the last quarter of the 17th century, that's the late 1600s, the status of the Negro in the eyes of the law began to change once more. His personal rights were reduced to a minimum, and he was left as a true chattel slave, unquote. And then I continue, as early as 1669, The status of the enslaved African in America had ceased to be that of a man or woman and had become merely that of a species of property. By the first quarter of the 18th century, the dehumanization of the enslaved Negroes was nearly complete. Edward Embry, an author in the book Brown Americans, relates that, quote, Henry Berry, speaking in the Virginia House of Delegates in 1832, described the situation as it existed in many parts of the South. And this is what he said. We have, as far as possible, closed every avenue by which light may enter the slave's mind. Now, this is a white scholar writing about what white people did. If we could extinguish their capacity to see the light, our work would be complete. They would then be on a level with the beasts of the field, and we would be safe. I am not certain that we would not do it if we could find the process, and that on the plea of necessity. And in conclusion to the extract, I'll say that this same author, Edward Embry, further noted that the situation did not improve for the Negroes with time, but the years dragged on with slaves. This is his words. The years dragged on with slaves and even free Negroes increasingly denied instruction, even the most rudimentary education in the South and meeting with neglect and intolerance in the North. At emancipation of all the 4 million slaves and a 500,000 free Negroes, only 5%, that's 5 out of every 100, could even read simple sentences or write their own names, unquote. Now, this kind of information, which was actually taken from a book that was written by a white scholar back in the early 1900s about what white people had done a century earlier than that, would probably not be allowed in some schools today, this book that I wrote, even though everything that I read actually happened. It's part of our American history. But some people don't want this kind of information to be taught to their children, even though they want the crossing of the Potomac River, or the crossing of the Delaware River, rather, by George Washington and his band of revolutionaries to be taught, because they were rebelling against what they felt was the unfair treatment of the British. But they don't want it to be in the history book about the unfair treatment of African Americans by the descendants and relatives of George Washington. And I'm just saying that this picture that I just presented is just as true as the ringing of the Liberty Bell back in 1776. If America's, you know, good, great historic moments are going to be represented to our children, why shouldn't those things that happened that America maybe shouldn't be so proud of be told? Otherwise, you get this completely slanted picture of American history, which basically goes back to almost denying that black people, who you see every day, in some communities they don't see black people, but in the bigger cities you see black people every day. It's like denying that we ever existed, or we just appeared in the 1990s, you know, in the situation that you see us in now, in the ghettos and some of us in middle-class situations. But they don't want to talk about how we got here and what happened to us after we got here for 250 years plus. So much for that. Like I said, you don't have to respond to that. I just want to get that out there. If anybody wants to talk about it, fine, but it's caller's choice. If you want to talk about something totally different, it's up to you. So I'll turn it over to my co-host, Mr. Bianchi. Go ahead, Mr. Bianchi.
Oh, that's very good. You got a celebration that's coming up here in another week or so. What's that? what do they call that? Juneteenth. What year was that? 1865. Oh, okay. Well, let me ask you a question. Why come they don't celebrate April the 28th?
Who is that?
Why come they don't celebrate? Why come they don't celebrate March the 21st, July the 19th?
Yeah, Mr. Packer, who are you referring to when you say they?
The people that like to celebrate Juneteenth, June 19th.
Well,
you know what
June
happened
19th,
on those days?
Well, you know, we know what the story of June 19th. Some of us do. Some of us may not. But I would
yeah,
say
but
this.
Yeah, but the day that I made mention of.
No, I'm not familiar with those. I was very ignorant for a long time.
You wasn't
time
taught that? You wasn't taught that in history? Let me tell you what happened on those days. It was June 14, 1866, when the Creek Nation freed their slaves. The Choctaw in Alabama, April 28, 1868. The Chickasaw in Mississippi, April 28, 1866. The Seminole, March 21, 1866. The Cherokee, July 19, 1866. Why come they didn't do it in 1865? It's because they were sovereign nations, and the United States government had no control over them. Matter of fact, the Choctaw and the Tickatall said, we ain't freeing our slaves unless you pay for them, which the U.S. government did. That's not taught. If they're talking about that critical race theory is bringing issues up that's not taught, well, let's talk about it all. And still, the ultimate choice of what their child is taught is left up to the parents. And the control of school districts, according to state statutes, is left up to the parents. If parents don't want their child taught that, it shouldn't be taught. And I'm not saying it shouldn't be. It can be taught as an elective in college, at grassroots, like many things are. And there's a lot of books that wasn't allowed in academia. Chancellor William, Destruction of Black Civilization, was not allowed in the libraries of Howard University, which is a historical black college. And that's not all. We could talk about the side of history that nobody talks about. But what we're seeing in this CRT is targeting one particular ethnic group, wanting to teach their children. Their parents don't want you teaching their children. The Chinese Americans have a big rally in Virginia. We don't want this. We don't want this taught to our children. So they're Americans, Chinese Americans, they're Americans, so should they not have as much stage, center stage as anybody else, right? They don't want it. States, legislatures, because of the pressure they're getting from the populace, we don't want that. Now, it's not saying that people, if you want it in your public school district, go ahead and put it in there and let it be. But at least you should respect those who don't want it. Right? You know, another thing, too, real quick. A lot of parents, black parents, didn't want their children pledging allegiance to the flag. So they would send a note with their child to the teacher and say, when this is being recited in the classroom, I want my child to step outside in the hall, which they had a right to do. So if you wanted to be okay for your child not to participate in the Pledge of Allegiance of the flag, well, shouldn't other parents have the right to for their children not to participate in a subject matter that they don't want their child exposed to? Just some food for thought. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Piaki. Thank you so much. We're going to go around the family room, and so Sister Stephanie, thank you for being with us tonight. You heard some comments from Ms. Bianchi. You heard a little bit of, that I said. You don't have to respond on this topic that I spoke about or that Mr. Bianchi spoke about. You can introduce the topic, but you have the mic, so you can take it away. Sister Stephanie, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Hi, everyone. I hope everyone is having a wonderful weekend. First thing I'd like to say, we have had so many graduates. And I'd like to congratulate all of the graduates for hanging in there and going strong and graduating, moving on in life with some positivity. I'd also like to say, when I was in high school and I went to a predominantly white high school, there was 10 of us blacks. We did have a black history book, a big, thick one. So we had a black history class. But later on, and that was in Connecticut, me and my sister, your wife, we went there. We both took the black history. But later on, our younger siblings in California was going to a school that was predominantly white, but they had more blacks and other nationalities at their high school. They didn't even have a black history class, a black history book, nothing. So our sister Frida, she started petitioning against this. And basically, the school wanted her out of there, but she got it where they start teaching some black history, some form of black history. I think whatever a school is teaching is what a child should be learning. A child just can't come and their parents come along and say, I don't want my child learning this type of math. No, this is what is a curriculum in the school. This is what they should be taught. I don't know nobody that ever walked out of class during saying the Pledge of Allegiance or anything like that. I know when I was a child, fourth grade in Virginia, I did go home and tell my dad the song that they had us sing every day after the Pledge of Allegiance. And I felt like it was racist. And as soon as I learned all the lyrics to the song, that's when I, you know, went and said something to my parents. And my dad did come up to the school and speak with them, and they took it off. But, you know, we were all patriotic and still are. So, you know, we just want the best for our country, but we don't want our history erased as if it was never there, no matter how good or bad it was. You know, and this is why it's important for us to continue to tell our young people our family histories as far back as we can go. And try to keep it as a memory and as history, you know, to the following generations. So, but congratulations to all the graduates. I think that's so nice. Yeah. All righty. Everyone have a nice one. Thank you.
Stephanie, before I go on to our next panelist, Brother One, I want to mention something that just came to my mind as Sister Stephanie was talking. Now, my great-great-grandfather on my mother's side was the father of Booker T. Washington. And his name, according to family tradition or family information, was Benjamin Ferguson. Booker T. Washington's father. And back in the 1850s, the Ferguson family was a very prominent family in that vicinity near Roanoke, Virginia. And so they were prominent enough that they may have appeared, or some of the members may have appeared in the Virginia school books, history books, about early history in Virginia. Now, the fact that their history included a man who would, by whatever means he did it, but probably it wasn't a love romance affair, because that wasn't the common way that these mulatto children came about. Sometimes it may have happened, no doubt. But generally speaking, it was a forced relationship. It didn't necessarily have to be violent rape. It could have been intimidation, or it could have been enticement. But it was something that was the exploitation sexually of our women. And so this happened to my great-grandmother, great-great-grandmother, Booker T. Washington's mother, with Mr. Benjamin Ferguson. Now, if something was in the history books about how great the Ferguson family was, and as planters and politicians and civic leaders in the Virginia history, and then somebody like myself, a descendant of the Fergusons, you know, wanted to also include that, yes, they did all that, but Ferguson also have a history of exploiting black slave women. There are people that would say, no, you can't have that part of the history of your family in the book. You can have the part about them being successful planters and civic leaders, but that part about Benjamin and those in the family like Benjamin that ran around to the cabins at night and sexually exploited the women, even though that's history, but that part of the history you can't let anybody know about that. And I think that's a great portion of why this issue is coming up, because over the last 50, 60 years, even going back over 100 years with people like Du Bois and others that preceded Du Bois, including Booker T. Washington, who wrote a number of books dealing with black history. A lot of them are not well known today. But he wrote a book called The Story of the Negro, which is a very good history book. It's not in print right now. But I'm saying that a lot of the books that went back far into history, and a lot of information now is being revisited. You got younger scholars that are writing some great history books about our people that tell both sides of the story, that tell the story about people like my great-grandfather's daddy and his family, but they may also tell about the great accomplishments that some of the Fergusons did. But they're going to tell both sides, which to me as an historian is only correct. But unfortunately, there are those that only want the positive side that makes them look good be told. And finally, and I'm going to turn it over to Brother Warren, and finally, you know, I agree with you, Stephanie, and I'll tell you why. Because I've studied, as an educator, I have studied the history of education, formal or public education in America. And part of the history of public education in America dealt with trying to Americanize the immigrants coming over from Europe, particularly the immigrants from Southern Europe, from Italy and Hungary from down in the area, the Baltics, as they call it, the people that weren't Nordic types, in other words, weren't like the Germans and the English, but had a shade darker skin, and many of them were Catholics, and they wanted these people to blend in so they would be more useful tools for the capitalist industries. So they wanted them to be not just educated to learn their ABCs, you know, the 3 R's and so forth, but to be socialized into the European, Caucasian, Nordic dominated culture, the English-based culture. And the parents did not have any say-so when their little Italian child went to school on what they were going to be taught, because the program was to basically make these children be able to blend in so they could be part of the American body politic, and there would be smooth sailing because they would basically lose a lot of their identity, and they would adopt those ideas that basically taught them Nordic-type English superiority. So now, of course, that's no longer the case, and as Ms. Kriyanki so well pointed out, parents do have the legal right to say what their schools are going to teach their children, but I think that right, personally, in my opinion, should be mediated or moderated by what should be the end result of the American K-12 education, in terms of when a student hopefully will graduate, when he leaves that school, when he's gotten his graduation diploma. What type of citizen should that person be? Should he be a white supremacist citizen? Should he be like Elijah Muhammad students? They were black supremacist citizens when they came out of his schools. That wasn't any better, you know, even though it was a counterpose to the white supremacists, but that wasn't the right way either. I was taught in one of those schools, and I look back now and I say, you know, we were actually, in a way, I won't say it destroying or corrupting, but we were actually in some way maybe damaging some of those children's ability to fit in and to work successfully in the jobs that they needed to get to take care of their families later on, because they had this idea that white people were trash or devils or lower than them, and society doesn't need it to go either way. But if a parent wants to send their children to these schools like they had in the 70s and the 80s, these so-called white Christian academies, where either directly or indirectly they were teaching white supremacy to these kids, I don't believe that they should have the right to send kids out into the community, especially at taxpayers' money, which black people are paying taxes too, with that kind of mentality. That's my 2 cents worth on that. Brother Warren, welcome to the show. Thank you for being patient with me as I gave my little talk there. And what do you think?
Yeah, what I had decided to discuss fits in with what you started off. I'm going to share with you pieces of an article from, well, it's actually an Associated Press writer, but it's I'm looking at it published in the Louisiana Weekly, which is our black weekly, been around for 95 years. The Southern Baptist Convention is, I think, regarded as the largest Protestant denomination in America. It's like 15 million people. They're like what you call the white Baptists. And the black Baptists belong to the National Baptist Convention USA, the National Baptist Convention of America, which was a split from the Baptist Convention USA, and then the Progressive National Baptist Convention, which was a split also in the 60s, led by Dr. Gardner Taylor and Dr. Martin Luther King. But the Southern Baptist Church, over the last couple of decades, have been gaining some black congregations. In fact, I have the number of they have here. They say that as of 2018, the Southern Baptist Convention had about 907,000 African-American members out of a total of 14.8 million, and roughly 3,900 predominantly black congregations out of about 51,500. So the point of the article is racial tensions simmer as Southern Baptist hold key meeting. Now, the point I'm getting at is how backwards many black people are for trying to be a part of a racist organizational structure. And so let me start with this part of this article here. Race-related tensions within the Southern Baptist Convention are high heading into a national meeting next week. The election of a new Southern Baptist Convention president and debate over the concept of systemic racism may prove pivotal for some black pastors as they decide whether to stay in the denomination or leave. It could be a watershed moment for America's largest Protestant denomination. The SBC, that's what it is for short, the SBC was founded before the Civil War as a defender of slavery. And only in 1995 did it formally apologize for that legacy. Yet since 2000, its black membership has been increasing while white membership declined. I want y'all to pay attention to that. The white membership is declining, but some of the blacks are coming into that denomination. I want y'all to think about money, okay? Over the past year, however, several black pastors have exited the Southern Baptist Convention in frustration over what they see as racial insensitivity within its overwhelmingly white leadership. Depending on the outcome at the meeting in Nashville, the exodus could swell or subside. Many black pastors are comfortable with the SBC's conservative theology and grateful for financial support, but did not want it to wade into conservative national politics or distance itself from the quest for racial justice. The Reverend Nate Bishop of Forest Baptist Church near Louisville, Kentucky, said some members of his black congregation want to leave the SBC while others want to stay, and he intends to assess the tenor and tone of deliberations in Nashville to guide decisions. Okay, I'll move up here. One of the SBC's most prominent black pastors, Dwight McKissick of Cornerstone Baptist Church in Arlington, Texas. Now, Dwight McKissick is very significant because he's been like the big black voice in that convention. So this is what he's saying. His church will quit the SBC if either of two leading conservative candidates win the presidency. Both have made statements that black Baptists would find anathema regarding racial matters and politics. McKissick said via email, quote, "I could not proudly call myself a Southern Baptist if either of them win." Now, these two candidates, leading candidates, they all have denounced critical race theory and the fact that there's systemic racism. So that's like the big issue going on right now. And so that's pretty much what I wanted to use to summarize what my point is. Here you have, now in New Orleans, we have one of these type of churches. There's a big black church called Franklin Avenue Baptist Church where the pastor, Fred Luter, was the first black president of the Southern Baptist Convention. Pretty nice guy. In fact, he's a pretty nice guy. But you are in a denomination. Here you have your own denomination that black people developed, that nurtured black people, that protected black people, that was the basis of the greatest movement for freedom in world history, the Civil Rights Movement. And you trying to knock down the doors, jump through the window, scream from the roof to be a part of an organization whose structure at its core is white supremacy and racism, and are reiterating it. at their convention next week. Now, when they used Fred Luter as the president, that was to give themselves a sort of brownie point. But they didn't change. And so how backwards can you be? I heard a guest on here say one time ago, he said, where would black people be without white people? You know what black people would be? They would be closer to their own humanity. They would be closer to their own human dignity as they've always been when they had their own organized structures. But when you allow yourself to be a token, when you allow yourself to be used, you have no manhood, you have no dignity. Now, many of these pastors are conservative. In other words, they agree with the Southern Baptist conservative theology, but they find their congregations are beginning to revolt. These black congregations, these members who see what continues to go on in society are beginning to revolt against these pastors, black pastors who want to play conservative politics for these white folks' money. Because what has happened is the Southern Baptists have helped many of these black folk financing the construction of their edifices, you see. And so now some of them are hesitant as to whether they're going to pull out or not. Now, this Dwight McKissick, what he's saying is very significant, because he was like one of the earlier type of blacks going in. His church is in Arlington. He's one of the first black persons going into the Southern Baptist, so on and so forth. So this is why our young people are so confused, because the educated adults who are supposed to be spokespersons and representatives are themselves highly confused. They don't know who their enemies are. They don't know who their friends are. They have yet to find their manhood. They have yet to realize they need to have dignity. And they allow themselves to be prostituted, sodomized, and exploited by these white people who, in this case, call themselves conservatives, who are letting the world know that they believe in white supremacy. Because, you see, all of this reaction against critical race theory is not so much that they are against the critical race theory in as much they are exercising their power of whiteness. They're saying we are white. And you're not going to make us ashamed of being white, which nobody ever said that's the case. But when the historical documentation overwhelmingly shows that you mistreated people inhumanely, you profited. Your financial well-being is based off of the exploitation of black people in all kinds of ways. That's the evidence. You would lose in court to argue against it. They don't want that truth to be told. They want a fantasy. They want, in essence, a Birth of a Nation history being told. They really want a Birth of a Nation history just kind of dressed up in the 21st century told. And so I just want to share with you that we'll be critical of our young people, and we're highlighting their faults. And we talk about their lack of drive for education and their inability to compete in rigorous high academics. Before we kind of put the spotlight on them, let's look at these people who are supposed to be educated with PhDs and articulate and leading congregations and leading them into the devil's kitchen. So some of these congregations in these black churches who are in the Southern Baptist, they're getting flack from the ministers. And the last part of this article, and I guess this guy is a Nigerian because he has a Igbo name. His name is John Onwuchekwa. It says John Onwuchekwa, pastor of Cornerstone Church in Atlanta, was a rising star in the Southern Baptist Convention before breaking with it last year. Among his reasons, he didn't want to be held out as an example for other black ministers to prove the Southern Baptist would be a good place for them. Quote, there's no doubt in my mind that there are good people in the Southern Baptist Convention, Olwuchekwa said, but when opportunities arose to make major improvements in race relations, quote, instead they take moderate baby steps not to offend the base. And who is this base? These are the Trump worshipers who believe Trump is the coming of Christ. That's who the base of the Southern Baptist Convention is. But these black pastors have led their black congregations into an organized structure with Trumpsters. And when you're a black pastor, you got a little black boy sitting in your church that the police would harass already, is built up into the what you call probable cause mindset. And you look at those black children, and you know how the society sees them. And then you got to go with these old racist white boys who gonna make statements against anything that they believe prove show them negatively. Then you have to ask yourself whether you're a man, whether you have any type of humanity or dignity there. And so I just wanted to contribute that to the conversation. Thank you, Mr. Warren.
Thank you, Brother Warren.
Thank you.
I'll next, John Cannon Bay, and I just want to make a very quick comment. Well, and I was familiar with that. I had read that article yesterday, actually, and it was one of the things that I had considered concerning making the topic, but because I wasn't as familiar with the issue as I wanted to be to really get into it, I decided to not bring it up. So I'm glad you did bring it up, because one of the things that I did read into the article that concerned and still concerns me is the fact that some of these churches, and the way I understood the article, now maybe individuals can join the Southern Baptist Convention, but I think it's churches that actually join as church bodies, and the Baptist church allows each church, unlike the Methodist, to operate relatively independently. So these churches, if they choose, they can join in various associations, including the SBC. But one of the things I read into that article is that one of the factors that's causing some of these churches to keep their affiliation is money. And you mentioned that.
Yeah.
And thinking, you know, to what extent are these larger white organizations holding our people hostage or keeping our people in a form of virtual slavery because they have the power of the dollar that they dangle like a carrot in front of a mule or a horse to keep us following, trying to get a chop off of that carrot, which will never really happen, but they keep us wanting to go towards that carrot, that as long as our churches feel that we can get support for whatever programs, whether it's church building or missions or, you know, even buying caseloads of Bibles or hymnals, you know, at a discount or getting them free. You know, a lot of our pastors and churches are going to cling to this, even though, in a sense, they're selling their souls to these white supremacist leaders of the SBC. So that's a sad thing, but I want to say this, and I'm going to turn it over. While you were speaking,
I want to say, Mr. Washington, the number we saw was about 900,000 blacks out of roughly almost 15 million. Well, that's not a number to be alarmed, you know, instead. But the white people in the mainline denominations, like the Southern Baptists, the white people are leaving those denominations. And so they have identified black people's dollar as something they covet to keep them afloat. So what they're actually doing is they're actually establishing churches in the black communities they call mission churches. So what you'll have is you'll have a church from the very beginning where the blacks go or be a Southern Baptist church. And in a church like that, the Southern Baptists control them outright. But you have other black churches that would be what they call duly aligned. They'll be a member of the National Baptist Convention, but they'll also be a member of the Southern Baptist Convention. And so it's basically, here go the hypocrisy, what these white folks are. They want to maintain white supremacy ideology, right? But they need, they don't want to tell the black people, we need these Negroes, because these Negroes' money is going to keep all of our operations and programs afloat, and we can get more of these Negroes in. But how arrogant you are when you still want to be a racist and then believe you're going to attract the black people. That's just how arrogant these white supremacists are, that they're going to stand on the pulpit and preach conservatism, which is a euphemism for racism or white power, basically, and then try to woo black people in. And what's happening with the pastors of the churches that are part of these Southern Baptist Conventions, some of their congregants are revolted and saying, let's leave this Southern Baptist Convention. And that's, but then again, if the pastor sold his soul to the Southern Baptist for some money to get a new church building built, well, then he's in a bad shape. He's in a tough spot there.
Well, absolutely. Thanks for turning over to Jake John. I'm just looking at related in a way to what this issue is all about, and that's the American Medical Association versus the National Medical Association. Now, when I was growing up, my uncle, who was a surgeon, was not allowed to join the American Medical Association back in the 50s because they did not have black members. So the black physicians joined the National Medical Association. But now minorities not only can join the American Medical Association, but they can receive scholarships to go to medical school and do post-medical school studies from the American Medical Association. And the American Medical Association has just come up with a new strategic plan where it says in this article that I'm reading that they have embraced critical race theory. This is a negative article, actually. The person who wrote this article is against this new plan where they're promoting the advancement of minorities. And they are actually, what I would say, encouraging black people to join the American Medical Association. So I'm thinking to myself, look at all the great strides in medicine that members of the National Medical Association had accomplished. I don't know for a fact, but I would imagine that Dr. Charles Drew, who was famous for his being able to develop the use of blood plasma for transfusion and saved a lot of people's lives during the Second World War and since that time, and others, and I can't name them all, but I do know of many who would come to Tuskegee every year. The National Medical Association would have their annual convention on the campus of Tuskegee. One reason was because there was this black VA hospital just 2 or 3 miles from Tuskegee campus where a lot of the doctors who were coming there for the convention had done their medical residency because of the limited opportunities. So it was kind of like a homecoming for many of these doctors, even if they didn't do undergraduate work at Tuskegee, they did medical residencies near the campus, and so they were familiar with that campus even before they had gotten out into their own practices. But these people did a lot. I mean, many, many things that you don't even hear about, they developed, and they would come together. They called this convention the clinic, and I remember going over there because my grandmother had a business selling candy, and so they would allow vendors to set up booths to sell, you know, different souvenirs and Whereas in my grandmother, she would sell the candy that she had manufactured, and she would send me over there to deliver or to bring boxes of candy to her sales ladies that were selling for her. And I got a chance to see a lot of these doctors, and they would have exhibits. They would have booths talking about some of the latest technology and doing different procedures and stuff like that, and it was fascinating. But this was the National Medical Association, and the sense that I'm getting, and it may be a little bit a stretch, but is that the American Medical Association now is pulling some of this talent from this body that has been very successful in encouraging and giving opportunities and networking, et cetera, for black physicians, and what I consider to be diluting the unity and the power of these black physicians to help each other and pulling in them and dispersing them through these scholarships that they're offering these black physicians. So these young folks now in their 20s and 30s who are going to medical school, instead of them feeling a real identification with a black-focused medical organization, they're going to want to become part of the larger mass where they may have support from the majority community, but they're not going to have that family strong support that helped them back in the day. So that's just something I thought I would throw out there. And I think a lot of that's happening in many other arenas where we had these forced because of segregation association, and now we are able to become part of the larger body. But are we as strong, and can we, as a group, as a community, serve the African-American community as well under this new paradigm? This is a question that nobody really has to answer tonight, but it's just something I wanted to say. So thank you all for being patient again. Sheikh John Cannon Bay, you've heard a lot so far, a lot of me talking, but you also heard Brother Warren, you know, talk about the SBC and those issues with them. You heard about the opinion of Ms. Bianchi concerning you know, what children should be able to learn in school based on their parents' preferences. You heard Sister Stephanie, and she's always given us a very positive side of the equation, which I really appreciate that. She keeps us lifted up with positivity. So now I'm turning it over to you, Sheikh John Cannon Bay.
Good afternoon, everyone. I've enjoyed the conversation. I've listened intensely, and a lot of thoughts ran through my mind. And what I finally decided to make a comment about is about Christianity, because I learned something about Christianity at the age of 36 that I didn't know. I received some answers. I attended a meeting on a Friday night. In that meeting, what was read was the beginning of Christianity. And which, let me just say, Christianity is a new religion. It's only 2,000 years old. So when you talk about the old-time religion, it's not Christianity. The beginning of Christianity, the foundation of Christianity, began in Rome. The Roman nation founded the first church, of whom crucified Jesus of Nazareth for seeking to redeem his people from under the Roman yoke and law. Jesus himself was a true blood of the ancient Canaanites and Moabites and inhabitants of Africa, seeking to redeem his people in those days from the pressures of the pale skin nation of Europe. Rome crucified him according to their law. Then Europe had peace for a long time until Muhammad I came upon the scene and fulfilled the works of Jesus of Nazareth. I had heard nothing like that. Nothing like that was in any of the books. Now, you can examine this and see if this is true or false, and you will find out that this religion of the Rome nation developed and the nation of our forefathers are for two different people, and two different people benefit from it. And we find that we collectively do not benefit from Christianity as promised, but at the same time, we are not encouraged to look at other religions brought by other prophets. And we examine the religion brought by other prophets, then we'll find out there's a universality about that. University in the sense that it manifests in the promise of the United States of America, the government of the United States of America, of the government of the Constitution of the United States of America, that broke down a lot of ancient customs that allow peace, love to peace, freedom, justice to flourish, because the promises of that are in the Constitution of the United States of America. Now, so you might, it might question, well, it took someone that really believed this to write this. So if Jefferson, Washington, Benjamin Franklin, and all those, did they write something that they didn't believe? Maybe they didn't write it. It was said that there was a brother in the room that told him what to write. Now this is tied into the Bible, which the Bible has a mixture of truth and untruth. What I mean by that is that some of the truth that's missing from the Bible is the work of our brother, Jesus of Nazareth, from the age of 12 to the age of 30, which is 18 years, of his life's works and teaching are missing from the Holy Bible. However, in the Holy Bible, it says that Jesus told us how to pray. There's a way you pray. It says, let thy kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. If you're praying for a kingdom here on earth like in heaven. And what the imagination of heaven is that everything that takes place in heaven is right. There's no wrong. There's no sin. It's a righteous government, but you're calling for it to be here on earth. And that righteous government, the closest that you can see of a government of its rules, regulations, and constitution, the United States of America fit that more than any other constitution, any other government on earth. Somebody, the bottom rail is going to raise to the top. So the people, the brethren of the people, the humans they're holding down, they have an opportunity to receive the instructions and be a part of the government that rise, that we wish for and pray for here on earth. Right now, the position in governments are held by politicians. The statesmen are kept out. Big money keep them out. Some of our people now are applying for these positions with no money, and just for the support of the people. And their agenda, and I think you'll find out there will be people that are fair, that people understand the principles of love, truth, peace, freedom, and justice. And that is going to occur because that's what we pray for, a righteous government here on earth. Peace.
John, Sheikh John Kennedy, that was truly inspiring.
Amen.
And I thank you for that. I mean, that to me is the capstone of our effort to present an open forum tonight. What you said has just lifted me up. But we do want to go around, and we're getting ready to close now, close a little bit earlier tonight. But I do want to say this before we go back and go around. You all, many of you, maybe all of you have heard Sister Baina Hamid on the show. She comes on rather regularly. She just lost a very dear friend today. My wife got a call about 3 hours ago where she learned from Sister Baina that this lady named Miss Mary, who was like another mother to Sister Baina, the lady was over 90 years old. Sister Baina lost her mother about 6 years ago, 7 years ago. And so this is a very hard blow for her. So I want you to keep Sister Baina in your prayers, you know, as she goes through this grieving process as a result of the loss of her dear friend and this lady who is almost like a mother to her. So please keep her in your thoughts and in your prayers. So as we get ready to wrap up, I want to just make an announcement for those who are listening via the Internet. If you would like to respond to anything you've heard or add something to the conversation, something that's on your mind that you would like to have our family room forum group talk about, please call us right now at 657-383-0671 before we close. We're going to go around the table, so to speak, go around the family room and get additional comments from everyone. So while that's happening, if you haven't been able to remember the number, I will keep that in mind, and I will give you the number again towards the end so you will be able to call in if you have something you would like to say. So we're going to go back around, and what we're going to do, since we would normally end with closing comments by Mr. Bianchi, I do want to give him an opportunity to say whatever he wants to say right now, but he will be the one who will be the last speaker. So after Mr. Bianchi, then we'll go to Brother Warren and then Sister Stephanie and then Brother John, and then we'll end with Mr. Bianchi. Mr. Bianchi, would you like to make comments as we get ready to wrap up?
Well, I want to make some observation. I really appreciate what Mr. Bay said. And with the king, with the Bible itself, and these characters that's in the Bible, I'm not a Bible person myself. I'm non-religious, but I know it very well because I can cross-reference these stories as they come out of what's known as the Shittat Neder. And funny thing, you know, actually Jesus did say that he didn't come for the whole world; he only came for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. He was very ethnocentric. Even the Cushites was ethnocentric. They didn't get along with the Egyptians. Why? Because the Egyptians was mixed, for one reason. In the Old Testament, Deuteronomy 7:3-4, it says, you shall not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons or taking their daughters for your sons, for they will turn away from your sons from following me to serve other who? Other gods. Other gods. Men created gods. Every ethnic group had their own god, which is perfectly fine in history. That's what they wanted to do. They done what they wanted to do. And people don't understand that. The Cushites did not have to have nothing to do with Christianity. They didn't want to have nothing to do with Islam. And the leadership that headed those dynasties from Mentuhotep, from the Menhoteps, and you can tell the throne name revealed what god they served, Amenhotep. The god was Amen, not Ra, which was the god of the Egyptians. But getting back to the schools, you know, the Nation of Islam had declared Muhammad academies, and in the onslaught, they was very popular. Now they are nothing more than a byword. Because Muslims around the country, and I don't know all the Ma's, but I know the two in the St. Louis area, that's Ma's 27, I think, in East St. Louis with Brother Ralph, and the one in St. Louis with Minister Donald. Those parents don't send their children to Islam's school, Muslim schools. Matter of fact, I met some students over at Cardinal Ritter, which is a Catholic high school, so like an infamous high school. And the people that pick up the biggest tab for that high school are white. And I know they complain in the emails and that because the majority of the black kids that attend that school is 99% black. They don't follow Catholicism. So that there is a problem. But yet and still, they still carry on because Cardinal Ritter, after the 1954 Brown decision, he was dissatisfied with the all-deliberate speed. So what he done, he desegregated the Catholic schools in St. Louis and built two high schools. The first one they built was in Walnut Park, which is a crime-ridden neighborhood. I talk about it all the time because blacks moved out of Walnut Park further west to farm communities or be in communities like Ferguson. So now they got a new one there on Spring and a brand new building. Well, it's not brand new, but that's where they go to. So I just wanted to put that out. You know, parents put their kids where they want to. Another famous Behind Cardinal River, they got Lowell Academy that the Jesuits built for black students to feed them into schools like Trinity and DeSmet High School. And these kids' academic performance is very, very good. They don't play basketball and football. They played at one sport that Jim Brown played. I can't think of the name of it. He was good at it. Then you got another high school, Christian Brothers Academy, CBC, Christian Brothers College, that built a new facility way further out by the Mormon temple. And your black politicians send their kids out there to CBC, that Christian school. That's what they want to do. So I don't blame parents for whatever denomination they take, whatever family, whatever denomination they take on. That's their business. You got people that want to have a separate nation. They don't have no separate nation. That's what some Marcus Garvey tried that in Jamaica. It didn't work. He came to the United States. A few people bought into it, but ultimately it didn't go no place. But I don't, Mr. Washington, I don't disparage people that have those ideas. If that's what they want to try, go ahead and do it. You know where the problem comes in is when they want to take your children and pull them into those. That I'll give you an example. I'm gonna let it go. The Uhuru Group opened up a building in St. Louis, and they want to have reading lessons, book lessons. So they want to steal the kids or take the kids from Julia Davis Library, which is a library that was built there on Newstead and Natural Bridge down the street from Ray Hagin's church in order to honor Julius Davis, that famous teacher. Well, go out and get your own kids. Why are you taking somebody else's kids? Now, if you don't have no attendance at the library, guess what the city's going to want to do? Close it. Thank you, Mr. Washington.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bianchi. And, of course, you close us out with final comments as we wrap up in a few minutes, but thank you for those comments, and we'll just go on around the family room. But before we do go to Brother One, I want to give the number out again because someone listening via the internet may have needed to go get something with which to write. So the number to call in is 657-383-0671. That's 657-383-0671. So we welcome your calls. And so please, if you would like to join us and contribute to this discussion, this lively discussion we're having tonight, please call that number. So Brother Warren, we thank you for being patient, and so I'll turn the mic over to you.
Would Sister Steph come before me? Because she came before me in the first round.
Well, actually, you're right, but I kind of wanted to give her the penultimate speak because she always gives us such a positive flavor, and I wanted to hear that as we get ready. Hope she doesn't mind. So you go ahead.
Okay. I do have a copy of Booker T. Washington's The Story of the Negro, The Rise of the Racial Slavery. Now, I have a 2009 reprint that Barnes & Noble did, and, of course, the book was published in 1909. And also, Martha White was a black lady. She died last week. Well, she died earlier this week. She was 99. She was one of the ones to lead the bus boycott in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, in 1953. Now, a friend of mine had a chance to interview Miss Martha White by phone, and he said, I talked to him today, he said the interview didn't go very well with Miss Martha White because even at 90, she was like 90 years old then. And she died, she's 99. But he said even at 90, she was very suspicious of anybody because of the FBI surveillance of her. So she even didn't say much, not even to her own nephew, about a lot of the things because how she had been harassed by the FBI. I want to say this. There's a joke. You had two conservative legislators, a white one and a black one. What? They were trying to pass a state law to eliminate the teaching of slavery in any history class in this particular state. And so there were some people who were sharing some authentic words of slavery from Frederick Douglass. They read to them what Frederick Douglass said, the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, and they read to those two what Frederick Douglass says in My Bondage and My Freedom. What was the response? The response was, oh, that's neo-Marxism and postmodern views. That's influenced by Black Lives Matter. That's a joke. I mean, it's a joke, but I mean, you might as well say it's real because that's pretty much what these people's response are. What's my point? Use the words of people themselves who were enslaved. All of the narratives that were written by people who had been enslaved beyond Frederick Douglass, and the 1930s interviews with over 2,000 people who were still living who had been slaves in the WPA Writers, Federal Writers Project. Those are the real words of what people who were enslaved said. But the response of these conservatives, blacks and white, would be, oh, that's that's the new term that they're coming up with, not neo-Marx. So they're using this Marxist communist thing like they did in the 50s and the 60s. Remember, the civil rights movement was Marxist. Remember, anything that was to break out of repressive situations in this country was called Marxism. Rock and roll was called communist. Well, they were using communism. It was communism. So now what they're saying is neo-Marxism, postmodern worldviews. So in that joke, the white conservative legislature, that's what he says about Frederick Douglass' work. Oh, that's just, and he was influenced by Black Lives Matter. That's just neo-Marxist. So the people said to the black conservative, what do you say? And the black conservative looks at the white conservative and says, well, yeah, whatever he says. All right, thank you, Mr. Washington.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much. And we're going to go ahead and move around and ask Dan for his closing comments. But I want to say one quick thing. You know, in my neighborhood, when I was a child, it was not rare. It was not unusual for me to be introduced to people that were in their 90s. Now, you think 1950s, if I met someone that was in their 90s, there was a good possibility that they might have been a child of slavery in the early 1860s. And I'm not saying that I can remember conversations where people told me as a child that they had been in slavery, but I wouldn't be surprised if I had not been in the presence of some ex-slaves. But I will say this. In 1971, when I was an adult, and I mentioned this on the program before, I did actually get a chance to know very briefly a ex-slave. And this ex-slave and I had a very good conversation. In fact, I asked him if he would come and speak at this meeting, this public meeting that I was inviting people to come to in the neighborhood. And so during the meeting, I asked him if he would tell the audience what he thought about the conditions in slavery compared to the conditions that he had experienced in the current time frame, which was in the early 1970s. And you know what that man told me? This ex-slave, he said, it's nothing. Nothing had really changed. Nothing has really changed. Now, of course, there were changes. You know, at that time, I had just recently been hired by AT&T as an executive. I had finished my third year at the University of California at Berkeley. Those were changes. There were major changes in terms of opportunities for me personally and many others. But this man who had actually been in slavery, he was still working in a very labor-intensive job. He was working at 125 years old, in a business that actually exported scrap iron out to different places to be melted down, or smelted as they call it, to make other fabricated iron material with. And so he was actually physically loading pieces of iron on to conveyors to be put on these train cars. But in his mind, he still saw himself basically in the same condition he had seen himself in back in 1865 when he was a child in slavery. That was him. I'm not saying everybody can see things that way. I didn't see things that way, but this is this man saying that. But anyway, that's just a little anecdote I thought I would share. So, Sheikh John Kenan Bate, what are your final thoughts before we get ready to wrap up?
Well, as you spoke about this gentleman and what he said, in essence, fundamentally, I think it's true. And the reason I think it's true is that the appearance of change that has been made is that we have been granted certain privileges, and privileges can be taken away at any time. So that's just a temporary situation addressing that he would look at the essence of what is going on. He was very, very hard to fool. That's the way I look at it. I want to make another comment about some of our senior citizens. They have a lot of knowledge, experiences that they will impart to us, but in order to get that conversation going, we have to spend time with them. You know, and that's something that a lot of us young people don't do. But I found out when you spend time in that conversation, there's some things come out of conversations you may have had talked with them a dozen times before. And here in this one conversation, all this information comes out. So the wealth of information around our people and their experiences, I think I kind of look at it like we're in a race. What kind of race are we in? You know what I'm saying? I think we're a relay race. In a relay race, you got to pass the baton from one part of the race until the next. So I'm saying, if you don't know how to pass baton, you don't perfect that. You're in a disadvantage to win the race. You're probably going to lose it. So I think that's something that we have to find out about this. The way I look at this baton, passing out a baton, and I see it's mind-boggling. A cousin of mine said that she has a niece, 24 years old. The niece finished at Florida University, historical black university, and said that she had never heard of John Lewis. You know, a lot of talk was about him after he passed. And that's the first time she had heard of him. That's why I'm saying the baton's been dropped some kind of way. You know, so that's an issue that we got to find some way to solve. We got to solve that problem. Peace. I'm finished.
Okay, well, thank you so much. And now I want to bring on my dearly beloved sister-in-law. And as I said, I wasn't actually going around her because I wanted to go around. I wanted to have her be the part of our closing, with Ms. Bianca being the final speaker, because she always says something that really lifts us all up in a special way. And so I'm going to go ahead and turn the show over to you, Sister Stephanie, for any comments you would like to make.
No, I just want to wish everyone well and blessings to everyone. And when we got on the subject of our precious Lord Jesus Christ, you know, I thank Jesus Christ for everything he has taught us. And I just want to remind us all when he was on that cross crying out to God, and he said, do not pray to him, pray to his Father. And but he taught us well. You know, as long as we watch out for the Jim Joneses and, you know, we believe and trust in God. And he gave each of us a brain, you know, so we have to use that brain to know wrong from right and not be taken advantage of if we don't have to. And I appreciate everything I heard on this show tonight. Thank you all. Baina, I'm sorry for your loss. God bless her soul in heaven. Everyone have a blessed weekend. Thank you.
Okay, and thank you. Thank you so much, sister. I just want to underscore something you said. But I'm reading a book, which actually is the Catechism of the Catholic Church. I actually was baptized and confirmed as a member of the Roman Catholic Church as a child, and I still study the Catholic doctrines and Catholic literature, even though I'm a Muslim, but I have not lost the interest in understanding what I adopted as my church and my religion as a young boy at 8 years old. And in this catechism it says, and this is to underscore what you just said, Stephanie, Christ invites us to filio. Filio is related to the Latin word filius, which means son. Christ invites us to filial trust in the providence of our heavenly Father. And this is referring to Matthew chapter 6, verses 26 to 34 as a reference. And it also says, and St. Peter, the apostle, repeats, cast all your anxieties on him, talking about our Father God, for he cares about you. And this is from 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 7, and also referring to Psalm 55, verse 23. And so you're absolutely right, Stephanie, that, you know, our Creator God, often called in religious language Father God, does care about us, and he loves us, and he wants us to love that which is right and good, because it's loving that which is right and good which will draw us closer to him, and we will be able to receive not only his mercy, but his heavenly rewards. And so I'll pass on to Sister Baina. She's not with us tonight. Your condolences and your prayers for her and her moment of grief. So thank you very much. And now for our closing comments, our co-host, Mr. Bianco, we welcome any comments for you as you close us out. So the mic is yours, Mr. Bianco.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. But people talk about blacks as in black skin or non-white skin. But when you look on the annals of history, you look at the great achievements that was performed by this ethnic group of people, of people phenotypically without white skin, it was as much as 10,000 years before any Christianity. Ursa Ma'at Ra Septepen Ra, Rameshu Mary Amun, that great warrior known as Rameshu II, the wars that he had when he defeated the Hittites at the Aronis River. Hittites are now present-day Turkey. And he led four divisions, 10,000 men each. One was Ra, one was Amen, one was Ptah, the other was Heru. It was named after his gods. Four divisions coming out of the Gaza Plateau all the way to the Aronis River. That was a marvelous feat that historians and war historians talk about today. How did they maintain a supply route? How did they feed their troops? How did they maintain their horses? There was no Jesus at that time. No mention of a Christianity. People like to talk about history, but they only go back so far. You walk with me, I'm going to walk you all the way back. And you're either going to be scared or you're going to change your thinking, because it's evident, it's right there. They detested Gideon. Matter of fact, it was women when he tried to come down into the Cushite land, the Kandakis. And I can't pronounce her name, I'm sorry, and I get really chewed out when I can't pronounce her name, by my elders. They fought off Islam for 700 years. Would not let it encroach into their domain, their territory. Wonder why Christianity didn't come into West Africa until the 1800s. Stanley and Livingston. Wonder why. Another thing, we talk about books. You can have whatever kind of book you want in your public school. When time comes for a high school to change over, their social study books, they let the top of those publishers that want to bid on them, they come into the school and they put their books on display. You have Penguin, you have HarperCollins, Simon & Schuster, Macmillan, People's Publishing. Their books on display for recommendation and reviews to be made, and then they choose from the popularity of those recommendations. But let me say this. Molefe Asante, who's a teacher, a professor at the university there in Philadelphia. What's this university? Temple University. He wrote a history book. It's called African American History. A good book. And when he first made that book, he had pictures of characters, of historical characters. Presently, it has Martin Luther King, Frederick Douglass, and Harriet Tubman on the cover. Guess who was there before one of them, and I think it was Harriet, but I'm not sure. Guess whose picture was on there before those, the final ones that's there now? Malcolm X. Why come Malcolm X picture didn't stay on there? People say it would nobody purchase the book if you had Malcolm X picture on it. So he agreed to take it off. I just wanted to say that to speak on reality and the total picture rather than pieces and parts. If you only gave part of the map, you would never get to the destination that you set out for. You got to have the whole map, the whole story. If you fall asleep halfway to the story, the good part at the end you're going to miss. May everybody have a safe and prosperous week. Talk to you next week.
Nuri, thank you. Traditionally, for the last few years, we've ended the program with the Black National Anthem. Used to be called the Negro National Anthem. Lift Every Voice and Sing. But I'm going to do something a little different just for tonight. It'll take me back to the time when I marched during the Civil Rights Movement. You mentioned Dr. King. He was a personal friend of mine. My father was the insurance man for the church that he first pastored in Montgomery, Alabama, and was the one that out of his own pocket paid off the claim when the church was bombed by suspicious people, I'm sure, with the Klan, needed to be prepared. My daddy came up with the money because the insurance company refused to pay the claim. And my father was the one that introduced me to Dr. King at the age of 12 years old. And I was with Dr. King at the last speech that I believe he made in his hometown of Atlanta before he was killed. So we have a number of years of history together. And during those marches, there was a song we students sang, which goes, I won't sing, but I'll give you the beginning of it in the words. I woke up this morning with my mind, Lord, stayed on freedom. And so here's a rendition of the music from that song.
We're now reading from my book, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, authored by Marshall Washington, Cabinus Abui, Professor of History, University System of Georgia, and the senior great-grandson of Booker T. Washington. I am a product of the Black Revolution. I was born in 1943, and I attended Tuskegee Institute, now Tuskegee University, during the beginning of the Black Revolution. I transferred from Tuskegee to the University of California in my junior year, and I was on that campus during the height of the Black Revolution. It was on the campus of Tuskegee University 3 weeks before his brutal assassination in New York that I encountered a prominent leader of the Black Revolution, Malcolm X, Alhaj Malik al-Shabazz. It was his declaration of war against white supremacy, freedom by any means necessary, the ballot or the bullet, that ignited the spark, that lit the fire of Black rebellion, and pushed the long smoldering Black resistance to white oppression into a full-scale revolution. When I left Tuskegee during the summer of 1966, the embers of revolution there had already begun to glow. A student revolutionary, a worker for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee who was attending Tuskegee, had been murdered in cold blood in front of a busload of Tuskegee students earlier in the year. In January, he was one of my closest friends. His name was Sammy Young Jr. Armed with a double-barrel shotgun, I helped to bury him. The eminent African-American historian and journalist Lerone Bennett Jr. noted that revolutions do not spring full-blown from the head of Zeus or Martin Luther King or, may I add, Booker T. Washington. He observed that revolutions are the product of a contented spirit that builds up over a period of time and accumulates and strains against the dam of social habit. The dam against which Negro discontent is focused is white power, and any realistic analysis of the Negro rebellion must begin with the Negro situation, a situation defined by power or the lack of it.
Marshall, can't hear you.
And so I just want to make a quick correction that needs to be made. I don't want to leave it the wrong impression, but revolutions are the result of the building up of a discontented spirit, and our spirit should remain discontented until our people and all people have received true freedom, justice, and equality in this country and other nations around the globe. Certainly here in this country, we have every reason to remain discontented, especially as the walls of oppression seem to be trying to close back around our lives through some of these resurging white supremacist movements. So let us continue to stay strong. And as the song goes that I'll get ready to play the music for, let's lift every voice and sing.
Amen.